from KXJZ in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up in the program, a former UN weapons inspector in Iraq, also the author of the Raw Sharks text, and countertenor Ian Howell. But first, some surprising words today in Sacramento's mayor's race. One of the city's business leaders endorsed challenger Kevin Johnson and used unusually strong language to criticize incumbent Heather Fargo, who's running for re-election. The Sacramento Metro Chamber of Commerce announced its position on the mayor's race today, and KXJZ News reporter Ben Adler was there. Ben, welcome back.
And welcome back to you too, Jeffrey.
Thank you. Why did the Metro Chamber, or rather the Chamber's Political Action Committee, decide to endorse Johnson for mayor?
They cited his vision for the city. They cited his thoughts on economic development and his desire to take the city to the next level.
Did they address any of the questions that have been raised about Johnson? First of all, the relative lack of details that he's come up with so far in explaining why he's running for mayor?
You know, it's interesting. I asked that question. I said, you know, we haven't heard Kevin's economic platform yet. And I said, you know, he must have been more specific with you in private than he's been in public so far. And I didn't really get much of an answer. I did get Matt Mayhood, the executive director of the chamber, to say we don't need to hear the specific policy positions from him. We know he's going to listen to us and that we'll have a seat at the table, which is something that we don't feel that we've had in the past.
Did the Metro Chamber also talk about Johnson's involvement with the St. Hope Public Schools, which has been somewhat controversial in some circles, and also the state of his some of the properties that he owns in Oak Park?
Neither of those specific topics came up.
Okay.
It was interesting that that wasn't mentioned. I mean, obviously, Kevin Johnson's accomplishments in his eyes and his supporters' eyes in the Oak Park neighborhood, in education and in economic development, are the basis for his candidacy. And I know a lot of people feel that a lot of his supporters feel if he could only do for the city what he's done in Oak Park, that the city would be a better place. I think there are people who would disagree with that. But I think that is really the basis of Kevin's candidacy and his track record.
After the press conference, you talked with Matt Mayhood, and he used quite strong language to talk about Mayor Fargo. What did he say?
Yeah, it was remarkably strong. He rattled off a string of projects that he said should have been further along than they are now. And then he went on to say this.
I don't think Mayor Fargo has demonstrated any vision for the city of Sacramento. And I think that's why we made the decision that we made, is Kevin is demonstrating leadership and he's demonstrating a vision for the future.
How much of the lag in these projects do you believe the responsibility for which lies with the mayor?
I think that there's key catalytic projects that could have been moved forward faster over the course of the last 4 to 6 years had the mayor taken a stronger role. The rail yards development, a new sports entertainment facility, potentially the towers on Capitol Mall, R Street, K Street, no strong leadership on the Sutter expansion, no strong leadership on the Mercy expansion. Those are areas where the mayor can stand up and say, by gosh darn it, we're going to get this done and this is how we're going to do it, and follow me. And that hasn't happened.
And you also talked with Matt Mayhood a bit more detail about the measures Q&R, which were the measures that would have created an arena in downtown.
I asked him, basically, was the mayor to blame there as well, or was it an issue of voters who overwhelmingly rejected those two measures? Was it an issue of voters making it clear that they did not want their tax dollars to fund a new arena?
I think the voters did speak loud and clear on Q&R, but Mayor Fargo was nowhere to be seen on measures Q&R. In fact, there was a leadership void from the mayor's office in that campaign.
The strong words from Matt Mayhood, who is executive director of the Sacramento Metro Chamber of Commerce. Its political action committee today endorsed Kevin Johnson in the Sacramento mayor's race. After this, you then went to see Mayor Fargo. What did she have to say?
You know, there was a lot of frustration, I think, in her voice and her campaign's voice. They said earlier in the campaign season that the Metro Chamber had posted a very complimentary notice or note or whatever on the Metro Chamber's website when they wanted the mayor to come speak at the Metro Chamber's State of the City event. And they, frankly, I think were very surprised by, maybe not surprised by the endorsement, but were surprised by the strength of Mayhood's comments.
Well, actually, I find that very stunning. I think that if he were to pay more attention, he would see that a lot of the good things that are happening in Sacramento right now really are the manifestation of my vision. If you look at a Second Saturday event and all the activity that goes on there, all the arts throughout the city, look at the expansion of the Crocker Art Museum, the 50 new restaurants in the central city that people are enjoying every day, which is why so many restaurant owners are supporting me, the 1,000 new housing units in the central city last year. The economic vitality in this city is very, very strong. In fact, I think the 5 million square feet that we built in the last 4 years in downtown is an unprecedented amount of growth in the central city itself. And rebuilding the core has been one of the core things that I have worked on. So I'm disappointed in his reaction and in his words, but I completely disagree, as do my supporters.
That's Sacramento Mayor Heather Fargo talking a little while ago with KXJZ News reporter Ben Adler. Ben, the Metro Chamber is not the first high-profile endorsement for Kevin Johnson.
He has been endorsed by the Sacramento Police Officers Association, by the Sacramento Central Labor Council, by two members of the City Council. Five of the other six members have endorsed Mayor Fargo, and the sixth, Kevin McCarty, has not indicated whom he's endorsed at this point. Mayor Fargo certainly has her own endorsers, too. She has Assemblyman Dave Jones, Senator Daryl Steinberg. She mentioned restaurant owners. She's talked about downtown business owners. She also pointed out that the Metro Chamber represents the entire region, and its interests are not just about City of Sacramento itself, which is why she feels that she has a lot of support within the downtown core.
Ben Adler, thanks so much.
Sure.
This is Insight. Former UN weapons inspector in Iraq speaks in Davis tonight about U.S. foreign policy. Scott Ritter was one of the top inspectors in Iraq between 1991 and 1998. Before that, his career included spells as an intelligence officer in the Marines and arms inspections in the former Soviet Union. Right now, he's in our studio. Scott Ritter, welcome to Insight.
Hey, thanks for having me.
How should the United States deal with Iran?
Responsibly is the answer. Now, the question is, how do we define responsibly? I think we have to look at it from, you know, two perspectives. One, we need to deal with Iran in a manner which best reflects the genuine national security interests of our nation, meaning that if Iran actually poses a threat to our nation, that threat must be dealt with. Two, we need to recognize that the United States is not, although sometimes we act as such, we are not a unilateral power. We are part of a global community. So any action we take against Iran, if we want it to be successful, must be conducted within a framework of international law, meaning that we have to operate in accordance with the Charter of the United Nations. The debacle in Iraq is the clearest example of what happens when America deviates from the rule of law, and what happens when we take military action when no known threat exists. And I would say today, Iran poses no threat to the security of the United States worthy of military intervention, and we are not working with the international community in a meaningful way to contain Iran.
Do you think Iran is now or has in the recent past been actively working to build a nuclear bomb, or at least start the process of building a nuclear bomb?
Two totally separate questions. The first one, have they been working towards building a nuclear bomb? There is no evidence of this, and I think we have to be careful and discern between, gut feeling, perception, and reality derived from fact. We have UN inspectors on the ground. They've been in Iran since 2002, carrying out concerted efforts to uncover what's transpiring with Iran's nuclear program. And the UN inspectors themselves have said there is no evidence whatsoever that Iran is pursuing a nuclear weapons program. Now, some people define a nuclear weapons program as being an overall process that's composed of separate steps, and that the enrichment of uranium, which we know Iran is pursuing, is one such step, and that by allowing Iran to move forward with the enrichment of uranium, we're basically facilitating an overall process that, when Iran links the component parts, becomes a nuclear weapons program. So there's a lot of focus on the enrichment program, saying this is part of a nuclear weapons program. The problem is international law, and I keep bringing it up, but the United States is a signatory to the United Nations Charter. Article 6 of our Constitution confirms this as the law of the land, and the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which you are signatories to, Article 4 gives Iran the right to pursue enrichment. So we have to be careful about condemning Iran for doing that which it is legally allowed to do.
And so without evidence of a nuclear weapons construction program, you would say that it would be inappropriate for the U.S. to take any hostile actions?
Well, not only inappropriate, but illegal and immoral. And I don't think we should ever divorce those two. I mean, on the one hand, we can talk about what America is capable of doing, and we are capable of striking Iran. But should we be doing this? This is the debate we need to be having in this country. Is this responsible action? Does Iran constitute a threat worthy of military action? Is there something taking place in Iran worthy of the sacrifice of American life? And void of fact, we don't act.
Of course, no evidence of something is now the same as saying that it isn't happening or isn't there. Do you have a gut feeling about it? Which, of course, is not the basis for making any major foreign policy decisions. But setting that aside, do you have a gut feeling about Iran? Do you think Iran is trying to build a nuclear weapon?
My gut feeling about Iran is that they are not trying to build a nuclear weapon. I mean, I'm familiar with nuclear weapons programs, both overt and covert. And I know what goes in to building either one of these. And clearly with Iran, there is not any evidence that leads one down either path. It's purely circumstantial. That evidence is brought together. And then when I take a look at Iran, it's a nation in grave economic distress. It's a nation with serious internal domestic problems. And what the reality of a covert nuclear weapons program and all that entails, it does not match the reality of what you see on the ground in Iran. It just doesn't make any sense on any level.
Germany in the early 30s had grave economic problems, probably graver than what Iran is experiencing right now. And within a few years, it was in a world war.
Germany was a nation that had, they might have had grave economic problems. They also had grave economic potential. It's a nation that had a history of irresponsible power projection. I would challenge anyone to demonstrate how Iran today has a history of irresponsible power projection to say Iran is doing that which the Bush administration has accused it of is to say that Iran has flipped 180 degrees in terms of proven patterns of behavior. And again, I'm not saying it's impossible for Iran to head down that path, but someone has to demonstrate this tendency with a little bit more than just uninformed speculation.
Let's say there were proof that Iran was trying to build a nuclear weapon. Could the United States actually destroy that program in a remote way without actually invading the country, but by using missiles?
Well, now we have two problems, because one, we have the physical destruction of the actual program, but then we also have to destroy the national intent. And I would say that simply bombing physical locations does not destroy that which induced a nation to pursue nuclear weapons to begin with. So, if Iran was actually pursuing nuclear weapons and the United States determined that this pursuit of nuclear weapons was incompatible with our national security, the military response would have to be more than simply a limited aerial bombardment. We would have to literally go in, occupy, and remove from power the government that sought to acquire these weapons to begin with. It would have to be a fundamental remaking of the behavior of Iran.
You mentioned earlier the arms inspectors in Iran. It's my understanding, though, that Iran has not been completely forthcoming in opening itself up to inspections by those people. How confident can we be that the arms inspectors could unearth evidence if there were evidence to uncover?
Well, the easy part of that question first is the latter part. The technology these inspectors bring to bear in a modern arms inspection environment is beyond that which any of your listeners, unless they are nuclear physicists, are familiar. I understand we're in an area where there are some nuclear physicists, so
no doubt.
They will concur. We're dealing with technology that detects particles to billionths of billionths of a particle. It's not inconceivable, but it's highly improbable that the Iranians would be able to hide a nuclear weapons program from these inspectors. Now, people talk about the Iranians jerking the inspectors around. The Iranians are in complete compliance with their obligations under the current safeguards agreement of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The international community has sought to compel Iran to accept what's called the additional protocol of inspections, but Iran is under no legal obligation to do so. So when the international community seeks to have Iran comply with a standard that Iran hasn't bought into, is it really Iran jerking the international community around, or is it the international community jerking Iran around? I mean, it's a complicated problem, and it has to be considered in the context of an American policy that seeks regime change in Iran and has a history of using intrusive inspections to gain data, not about disarmament, but about removing the regime from power. And I'm talking about Iraq. So I'm not here saying that the Iranians are perfect and they aren't deserving of criticism, but I'm saying that the situation is far more complex than maybe we're getting on first brush.
Scott Ritter is a former UN weapons inspector in Iraq. He was there in the 90s. He speaks tonight in Davis at the Varsity Theatre about Iraq, Iran, and U.S. foreign policy. Do you happen to know any of the inspectors who are in Iran?
I do, actually. I worked with many of them when I was doing the Iraq inspections, and I have the highest regard for these individuals.
Are you able to talk with them today about what they're doing, or is that so classified that no one can talk with them about it?
If I go to Vienna or they come to New York, we go out for beers and we have informal discussions. But we need to be respectful of the fact that they have a difficult job to do and that discretion is an absolute requirement. You can't expect these people to go into Iran and gain access to the information that they're gaining in Iran and then to hold the confidence of Iran by coming out and spilling the beans. So we do have conversations, but I limit what I ask, and they limit what they answer.
Is it dangerous work being an arms inspector? I mean, just in general, but also specifically when you were in Iraq in the 90s?
You know, there are two totally different situations that exist. With Iran, we do not have a situation where the Iranian government is actively conspiring against the inspectors. In the early days of the inspections in Iraq, the Iraqi government was actively withholding information, actively concealing information, and oftentimes resorted to armed force to prevent the inspectors from closing in on that which they needed to find. Later on, when the United States used the inspection regime for a vehicle of spying on the Iraqis likewise would block access to facilities using armed force. And it got a little hairy at times. I would say that the experiences, though, that I had in Iraq are not being paralleled in Iran, that it's a completely different environment that the inspectors in Iran are operating under. Thank goodness for the inspectors.
When you were an arms inspector in Iraq, what did you know about Saddam Hussein's weapons, you know, weapons of mass destruction?
Well, I wasn't just a arms inspector. I ran the intelligence program for the United Nations Special Commission, and so I was the lead liaison not only for the entire inspection operation while it operated inside Iraq, but also with the intelligence services around the world. And I would say that I and the inspectors that worked for me were the most well-informed people outside of Saddam Hussein himself about the weapons of mass destruction programs in Iraq. We knew so much that every intelligence organization in the world deferred to our assessments because we had the knowledge, the data to back up our assessments.
Did he have weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons, biological weapons, or nuclear weapons of any kind when you were there?
Oh, absolutely. In 1991, when we started our job, Iraq was on record as having long-range ballistic missiles, chemical weapons, biological weapons, and pursuing a nuclear weapons program. The Iraqis never denied this. They just tried to hide the extent of their programs, and our job was to uncover the totality of the truth. This fundamentally changed in 1995, 1996, when the Iraqis acknowledged that they had lied to us, that they had deceived us, and they put all of their holdings on the table. The problem was, having lied to us once, we had to raise the standard of verification. We couldn't give the Iraqis the benefit of the doubt. And so we had to go through a very stringent verification inspection regime to confirm that we weren't just getting the wool pulled over our eyes.
You left Iraq in 98. What did Saddam Hussein have at that time?
We know that we could account for 95% to 98% of the physical weapons of mass destruction. We know that we were monitoring 100% of the industrial facilities that had been used or could be used for producing weapons of mass destruction or components thereof. We know that the unaccounted for material deteriorates over time, so that any unaccounted for biological agent last produced in January 91 with a shelf life of 3 years is no longer a viable venue of investigation in 1998. We knew that we couldn't account for 100% of his past programs, but we knew that we had fundamentally disarmed Iraq.
My guest is former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter. He was in Iraq from 1991 through 1998. When President Bush and other members of his administration were, a few years ago, before the Iraq war, when they were saying that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, what did you think?
Well, first of all, we have to acknowledge that weapons inspectors left Iraq in 1998, and the president of the United States is speaking vociferously about the presence of weapons of mass destruction in 2002, and that there's a four-year gap. And so there is a possibility that couldn't be ignored that the president knew something I didn't know. I could say that the president was talking about data up until 1998, then the answer is he's wrong. What happened, though, is that the president and his advisors were pressed on where is this data, where's the new information, and they themselves acknowledged that there is no new intelligence from 1998 to 2002. It's simply a reinterpretation of the data that existed from 1998 prior that was reinterpreted in the context of September 11th. And as soon as I heard that, I said, you guys have nothing. There's no weapons of mass destruction program in Iraq because there's no way you can reinterpret the absolute data that I was in possession of as of the time of my resignation in August 1998.
You also conducted arms inspections in the former Soviet Union. What about Russia today? Do you consider Russia to be a reliable, trustworthy friend of the United States?
Well, let's flip that coin over. Does Russia view the United States to be a reliable, trustworthy friend of Russia? And the answer is no. The United States seeks to irresponsible expansion of NATO. The United States uses NATO in an offensive military force against a Russian ally, Serbia. The United States puts missile defense installations right on Russia's border. And the United States withdraws from the ABM treaty. No, the United States isn't a reliable partner. So, you know, Newton's second law of physics applies to diplomatic relations as well. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And we should not be surprised to see Russia responding to the irresponsible policies of the United States in regard to Russia.
How does a person become an arms inspector?
The million-dollar question. Normally, you'd like the resume of a chemical weapons inspector to say chemist. The same thing with biologist for biology, nuclear for nuclear physicist, and ballistic, rocket scientist for ballistic missiles. I don't have that in my resume. I'm an intelligence officer. I'm a spy. I was brought in after the fact when it became clear that Saddam Hussein was not cooperating, that they were actively hiding information from the inspectors. My job was to gain access to information in a denied environment. One of the benefits of that is that I came in fully cognizant of the reality that I wasn't an expert on these different subjects. So I had the wherewithal to surround myself with the actual experts. But I was invited by the United Nations based upon the fact that I was a weapons inspector in the former Soviet Union. I got that job because in between drinking beer and playing football in college, I took Russian language. And somehow they thought I was a Russian linguist, and they sent me over to do this job. I had to grow into the job, a lot of on-the-job training. But you combined my status as an intelligence officer with my arms control experience in Russia and the fact that I fought in the first Gulf War against Iraq with the focus of my combat effort on Iraqi WMD when the UN needed somebody to come in and create this intelligence unit. My resume, my experience happened to be exactly that which they were looking for.
So were most of the people working for you scientists and people like that?
Oh, absolutely, especially early on. A lot of pasty-faced, thin-necked, thin-armed people who hadn't much experience outside of a lab. They're good people to be with, but when we had these contentious inspections, they weren't exactly the guys you wanted on the front line. So near the end, we brought in a lot of diverse people, a lot of guys that we called ballistic missile inspector in quotations that had necks that looked like NFL linebackers and arms bigger than most people's thighs. We had to bring in these kind of people because we were in a very confrontational process.
I caught your phrase, getting information in a denied environment. How do you get information in a denied environment, especially when this environment is a country that's being run by a dictator and is a former enemy? And in war.
And remember that when we went into Iraq, we did not go in armed. We came in, the best weapon we had was a blue passport that said, we are UN weapons inspectors. Our only authority was that which was given to us by the Security Council in passing a resolution. You have to be clever. What we would do is a process I called shaking the tree. You know, we know if we send an inspection to a given site, we'd probably be blocked. So what we'd do is take advantage of the knowledge beforehand that we would be blocked to collect the information. We'd fly a U-2 spy plane overhead to take photographs, knowing that when we came in, vehicles would scatter, and we'd track where the vehicles scattered to. We sent in teams beforehand to listen in on the communications. This is all done covertly. And we'd spin the dials and isolate frequencies. And then when we went to an inspection site, frequencies would come alive, and we started putting pieces together. And sooner or later, we were able to say, we need to go here, we need to go here, we need to go there. We used spies that other nations recruited. I worked very closely with the Israeli intelligence, with Russian intelligence, British intelligence. We operated not only inside Iraq, but outside Iraq. When the Iraqis sent a delegation, we would track them to the capital they were going to. We'd get the government to take the Iraqis off for a wonderful night on the town while we broke into their hotel room photographing their documents. And this is how we controlled the Iraqi weapons programs.
Well, what you were doing was of the highest importance, and the stakes were very high, but still you're smiling as you remember these stories and you tell them.
Well, it was the best job I ever had. I mean, it was everything you'd ever want to get out of a James Bond type experience. I got to do the A to the Z. I got to conceive the inspection. I got to sell the inspection to foreign capitals. I spent time in the Situation Room in the White House briefing, the vice president and his staff. I spent time in England briefing the prime minister. I spent time in Israel and France and Russia and Germany. I met the king of Jordan. It was the greatest job in the world. Then you get to go to Iraq and actually do it. And like I said, the doing was sometimes pretty interesting.
Scott Ritter is a former UN weapons inspector in Iraq. He speaks tonight in Davis at the Varsity Theater about Iraq, Iran, and U.S. foreign policy. Scott Ritter, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, the author of the Raw Shark Texts. He's in Sacramento. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Children with special medical needs often wait months for life-saving care. Tomorrow in Insight, pediatric specialists tell you why they fight for California's sickest children. Plus, members of the Saturday Club reminisce about Sacramento's oldest musical organization. It was founded in 1893 to promote classical music. The Raw Shark Texts, the remarkable first novel by Stephen Hall, is just out in paperback. It's about a man who wakes up in a house he doesn't recognize and is unable to remember anything about his life. The book is about his attempt to find out what happened to him. Author Stephen Hall lives in England but is touring the U.S. Today he's in Sacramento. Stephen Hall, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much.
Tell us about the title. It's a striking title, The Raw Shark Texts.
Yeah, it's a wordplay on the inkblot test, the Rorschach test. Partly because I was sort of interested in this idea that when you're reading a book, what do you actually see? You know, if you're watching a movie, you see the images, you see the characters, you know, you see them running about the street, you see things blowing up, depending on what kind of movie it is. But with a book, you don't see anything. All you see is symbols. All you see is the black ink on the white page. And so it's kind of a clue to the idea of the book is looking at how much comes from you as a reader as opposed to the writer. And I was trying to sort of push that idea to see, you know, how much the reader could kind of create. So it's a clue to that.
You mentioned the personality test, and there's actually one on your website.
There is, yeah.
Which I tried out, but I chickened out from sending it. Why is it there? Just for a joke?
Just for fun, really. You know, we were playing around with different things we could do with the book when it came out, and I thought it would be a great idea to actually have an inkblot test there. And you get to talk to one of the characters in the book. The main character's doctor answers your questions. And so I sat down and I wrote all her responses for that. And at first we answer them all by hand, and now we have a machine that does it, but first answer them all by having fun, because every so often someone I knew would do the test. And so I'd use my insider knowledge of their life to really freak them out.
Stephen Hall is author of the Rorschach Tests. He speaks at the Sacramento Borders tonight at 7. Would love to hear you read from the book.
Sure.
This is the very beginning, the first page.
It is, yeah. It's always good to read from first pages, I think. Otherwise, you spend your whole time trying to explain what's happened up to that point. So I tried to write a first page that you could read from. So here goes. I was unconscious. I'd stopped breathing. I don't know how long it lasted, but the engines and the drivers that keep the human machine functioning at a mechanical level must have trip-switched, responding to the stillness with a general systems panic. Autopilot failure. Switch to emergency manual override. This is how my life started. My second life. My eyes slam themselves, capital O, open, and my neck and shoulders arch back in a huge inward heave. A single, world-swallowing lung gulp of air. Litres of dry oxygen and floor dust whistled in and snagged at my throat with knifey coughing spasms. I choked and spat through heaves and gasps and coughing heaves. Snot ropes unwound from my nose and my eyesight melted into hot blurs over my cheeks. The shudder-hacking violence of no air, and then too much, knocked me dizzy, sent the floor tilting away under my fingers. Static behind my eyes, bacteria swarmed dangerously towards another blackout, and, snowblind and shaking, I pushed my wet mouth down tight into the palms of my hands, trying to pull controlled, steady breaths through my fingers. Slowly, the world began to reappear in sickly greens and thumping purples, and after maybe a minute, it steadied itself into a shaky solid kind of balance. I wiped my hands on my jeans and gave in to the last scratchy cough before rubbing out the last of the tears. Okay, just breathe. We're okay.
That's Stephen Hall reading from his bestseller, The Rorschach Tests. Did you start the book with that?
No, originally, that was the start of chapter 6, I think. You know, there's a lot of chopping around to try and make the book work, because it has a lot of different ideas and it tries to do a lot of different things. And originally, there was a chapter which is much further on in the book now, which starts. Imagine you're on a rowing boat on a lake, which kind of sums up a lot of the big concepts in the book. And then there's a chapter that looks at something else that the book tries to do. You know, it was all going very well, and a writer friend of mine checked over the manuscript and he said, you know, this is good, Stephen, but you do know your story chart starts in chapter 4, right?
So what did you do? Did you actually cut out what were then the first few chapters, or did you just move them into other parts of the book?
I just moved them around. You know, it was a case of realizing that the book was so complex anyway in a lot of respects. You know, the ideas were complex, that the reading experience shouldn't be too complex and that it should be linear. You know, so we should start where Eric starts, where I just read from, where he wakes up and knows nothing. And then we learn about his world and what's happening to him at the same time he does, which I kind of like that. I think, you know, because when you start a book, you don't know the characters, you don't know the world, you don't know anything. And so to start alongside a narrator who's in the exact same position seemed like it made a lot of sense.
It's such a shockingly violent start to the book. Do you have any experience of near drowning or anything like that?
Not near drowning as much, as although I'm kind of terrified of deep water, which fed into the book a lot. I remember, though, I went through a phase as a kid where I'd wake up convinced I'd stop breathing and just, you know, that gasping moment. So I think a lot of that fed into it, that panic of, well, what's happened?
Well, I know you don't choose the cover of your books, at least authors don't usually, but that's pretty deep water on the cover of the book.
It is, isn't it?
And so what do you make of sharks? Are you interested in sharks?
You know, I love sharks. I think they're absolutely fascinating. You know, people say, so why there's a monster in the book of sorts and it's a shark? And they say, you know, why go for a shark? And I come up with some kind of complicated answer about, you know, the fear of the unknown and the depths of the unconscious. But it boils down to the fact that I just think sharks are really, really cool.
In your MySpace page, you list all these things that you like,
uh-huh.
And a lot of the movies are, you know, the sort of, you know, from the last 10-15 years, a lot of like Blue Velvet, V for Vendetta, 12 uh-huh. Monkeys. But then at the end you say your all-time favorite is Casablanca.
That's right.
And your all-time favorite seemed so different from just about all the other films that you say you like.
I think it only appears to be different because we're so familiar to it. You know, we're so used to that film. But, I mean, if you think about that film objectively, it's probably one of the most experimental films of its time in that it looks like all the other films they made back then, except nobody gets what they want. Nobody's a good guy. Everything goes wrong for everyone. Nobody wins. And everyone just realizes, well, that's life. You know, we have to move on. And, you know, I thought that was such an interesting take on a film, especially from that period. And I know there are reasons why the film was changed so it was like that, you know, because there was a war on and they couldn't kill off the character who was meant to die so Bogey would get the girl at the end. And so, you know, they had to come up with this really strange ending. But, you know, I think we're just so familiar with it. We don't see what an unusual structure for a film that really is.
Another one of your favorite films is Moulin Rouge, and one of the stars of that was Nicole Kidman, and she expressed interest in your book at
she
one
did
point.
She
tell
did
us
yeah
about that.
Well, what happened was it was all kind of crazy. I'd finished the manuscript and I'd sold it to a UK publisher who bought the world rights for the book, which means they then have the right to sell it internationally. And so they took the manuscript. It was all very cloak and dagger. I think they sent it to like 40 international publishers from a laptop in Amsterdam at midnight or something. and we got all this great feedback, you know, lots of people were interested. But what was really kind of unusual is that we got two film offers and we'd not sent it to any film company. So people had somehow got it within 24 hours and made offers for the film rights. And one of those offers was connected with Nicole Kidman. And she'd got hold of the manuscript. I'm not quite sure how she got it, but she read it herself. And as far as I'm aware, she took it around two or three studios and just said, I love this book. Will you buy it for me?
Without having talked to you?
No. And then she did all that. And then she decided she kind of liked to talk to me. So she called me up.
That's nice of her.
Yeah. So she called me for a chat. And yes, one of the most surreal moments, because obviously she's very busy and I kind of knew she was going to call. We'd call and said, Nicole would really like to talk to you.
Your people told you.
Yeah. They said, do make sure you're in. You know, it's kind of important. So my girlfriend sat in watching the TV and it gets to the time when she's going to call and the phone starts to ring and I just freeze and she just looks at me and says, well, you know, you should pick that up. It is Nicole Kidman. But yeah, she was really lovely and she said such nice things about the book.
This is your first novel. Mm-hmm. It's been published in 33 countries.
Yeah.
That's a lot of countries to
it's
be published
in. It's a lot
in
of countries.
And film interest. When did you get a sense that the Rorschach texts was going to be a success? A big success?
You know, it's funny because you can't write a book thinking this book's okay. You've got to write a book thinking this book's going to really, really blow people away and you've got to really love it and believe in what you're doing. But I didn't think for a second anything like this would happen. You know, I was kind of hoping I'd be able to sell it and maybe pay off my credit card. And like I said, we sent it to one publisher, you know, a publisher called Canongate, a small independent press in the UK who I really liked the work they put out. And they sent it out and they called and they said, you know, we've been doing this 20 years and this has never happened before. And that was kind of an indication that things were going to start to snowball. And then they just did.
Stephen Hall is author of The Rorschach Texts. He's at the Sacramento Borders bookstore tonight at 7. What were you doing before you wrote this book, or in fact, while you were writing this book? What you were doing for money?
Yeah, anything which would kind of pay the bills and afford me time to write, really. You know, I was an office dog's body for a while, you know, filing and data
dog's
entry.
Dog's body being English word for just Joe Blow, I guess.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. You know, filing, typing in data, anything that you don't actually have to think about. So I could spend my time thinking about trying to write the book. So pretty much straight out of university, I've just been trying to write.
And tell us more about where you're from.
I'm originally from Manchester, England. Well, I'm from a town called Glossop, about 20 minutes out of Manchester.
Yeah. There's a lot going on in Manchester, isn't there?
Yeah. The north of England's an exciting place to be. You know, we've had the Beatles from Liverpool, and then you've got the whole Manchester music scene in the 90s, and now all of Leeds and Yorkshire is becoming a really exciting place to be and work. So, yeah, it's great.
But you don't live in Manchester now. You live in Hull.
I live in Hull, yeah.
Which is a less romantic place to be.
It's kind of a frontier town for the arts, which I really, really love. And there's some great people working there, and there's some great bands coming out of there now. And, you know, it's the thing I like about Hull is it's kind of kept its honesty in a lot of ways, you know. You find a lot of the northern cities have become very, very cool now. And although they'd hate to admit it, you know, they know they're very cool. Whereas the people in Hull, you know, you meet someone in Hull that says, oh, I'm working on a novel, and they really are working on a novel. Whereas in Manchester, everyone's working on a novel.
Your publisher says that, I just want to make sure I'm right, I'm reading this correctly, that your follow-up to be published in 2010 is being kept closely under wraps. Is that just hype, or is there some reason why it's so closely under wraps?
It might be because I've not told them very much about it. No, there's a few things that we're doing with it, and a few things that I want to try and do with it, which we're going to keep secret even after the books come out. So there'll be a few tricks and surprises with the publication of that book. So I'm trying not to say too much about it.
Okay, understood. Stephen Hall, author of The Rorschach Texts. He's at the Sacramento Borders on Fair Oaks tonight at 7. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, countertenor Ian Howell. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can download previous editions of Insight for free. Our archives at capradio.org/insight. Sometimes in Baroque music, you'll hear a man singing in a relatively high pitch. He's called a countertenor. One of America's top countertenors sings in Davis tonight with the group The American Bach Soloists. We'll talk with Ian Howell in a minute, but first, here's a sample of his singing. Ian Howells singing Non so se sia la spemi. It's an aria from the opera by Handel called Circe. Ian Howells on the phone. Ian, welcome to Insight.
Hi, Jeffrey. Thank you. How are you doing today?
Well, I'm doing very well, thank you. What does it take for you as a man to sing at a pitch like that?
Ooh, that's a complicated question. There are lots of different types of countertenors, just speaking physiologically. An easy way to think about it is that the actual vocal training is exactly the same as though it were a tenor or a baritone. When it comes to breath support and resonance, all of those things are exactly the same. But think of a guitar string, right? You play a guitar string, you'll get a certain pitch. Then if you cut the guitar string in half, if you fret it at the 12th fret, the resulting pitch is going to be an octave higher because there's less mass, less length. So what countertenors basically do is the same phenomenon just with the vocal cords. So when I sing, I just sing on a shorter length of chord, so the corresponding pitch is higher.
When untrained men sing in a high-pitched voice, they can't do it for very long because their vocal cords get stressed.
Sure.
Is it stressful for you as a trained countertenor to sing at a pitch like that?
Well, if you think about it this way, it's kind of funny. Basses, can smoke cigarettes and drink martinis before they go out to sing, right? But sopranos, really have to warm up and work to be able to hit all of their high notes. And a lot of that has to do with the specific stress that's put on the vocal cords in terms of the frequency of vibration as the muscles move against one another. And a countertenor, because I have, a male set of vocal cords that are longer and therefore more massive than a female's who might be singing the exact same ranges as I do, my vocal cords have to vibrate about four times faster to produce the same pitch. So, there is an element of fatigue built into the mechanism, an element of increased stress versus, female singing in the range. But, you hit a certain point where you really become a singing athlete. And so you train specifically to be able to handle those stresses and use your body efficiently within those stresses.
Does that mean that you have to work harder to sustain a long career as a countertenor, say, work harder at it than a male tenor or bass?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I hope to have a very long career. And I'm very conscientious about my technique and about working. And I don't think I ever think about it in terms of having to work harder than anybody else. I just have to, you know, I have to deal with the physical reality of it is my voice, and I just move forward from that point.
Ian Howell is a countertenor. He's singing with the American Bach soloists tonight in Davis at the Community Church at 8. Why did you decide to become a countertenor, or was there something about your voice that meant that was what you had to be?
Interesting. There's competing views on this as to whether a countertenor is, a genuine voice type, or whether a countertenor is somebody singing as a countertenor. That's a choice that they make, and they could do other things. And I come down somewhere in the middle on the issue. I think that countertenors can and should train the full range of their voice. I mean, you listen to the way I talk, and I'm clearly a baritone, right? But there's something about, you know, just the unique ability that I have singing in the countertenor range that is, it's more supple, it's more sweet, I'm more able to be expressive than I am in a baritone range. So my personal story, and everybody has a different story, is I think I was 20 or 22, and I'd been singing, you know, tenor in my college choirs and in my high school madrigal group as well. And, it worked for choral stuff, because when I got up to the upper part of my tenor range where things didn't quite work very well, I was always able to flip into this other voice that I had. And I think maybe when I was 20 or 22, I just decided I'm going to change directions. I'm just going to sing alto.
Let's listen to another clip of your work. This is a song called Have You Seen the Bright Lily Grow?
That's a good one.
It seems to me that so much of the countertenor repertoire is from the Baroque era or earlier than that. Is there much for you as a countertenor to sing that is more contemporary?
That's a good question. The glib answer is, of course, any piece of music that fits a countertenor's voice range is appropriate for a countertenor. The less glib answer is that, you know, we definitely have cultural prejudices that work against the countertenor. You know, a lot of people don't consider it to be a real voice or a true voice or a natural voice. You know, harking back to your previous question as to whether it's something genuine or whether it's just a choice. Guys like David Daniels, when his CD of Berlioz's Nuit d'Été came out, and, you know, the guy is singing Berlioz with an orchestra playing in a fully romantic style, just, you know, in a way, it gives the rest of us permission to stretch the boundaries of our repertory choices. Mm-hmm. The Baroque canon offers great music, which, you know, is appropriate for countertenors because there were countertenors in the Baroque period doing this, in addition to the castrati as well. But and it fits, you know, a lot of countertenors have a lighter mechanism, a lighter sound than you might find in like a Verdi tenor or something, or a Wagnerian soprano. So the affect of the Baroque music is very appropriate. But when I program recitals, I program Purcell songs next to songs by Kodály. I do Berlioz. I do a mean Richard Strauss. Sky's the limit as far as I'm concerned.
So in the past, they did not rely on castrati or castrated men to sing these roles. They also had men who were trained to sing as countertenors.
Yes, and of course there's also a rich cathedral choir tradition which still exists to this day of men singing as altos.
Mm. And why is it called countertenor? What does the part counter refer to?
Oh, sure. That That term was revived in, I guess it was the 50s, when Alfred Deller really came to prominence and they needed a name for his voice type, which wasn't alto, because they needed to, you know, the Germans, it's great, they have gendered nouns, so they call them altus versus alto. That's, they call countertenors altus in Germany. But in English, we don't have that. So started calling countertenor, and what it is it harkens back to the very, very beginnings of polyphony, where initially you would have a cantus firmus, right, mm-hmm. which was generally based on a Gregorian chant. And then composers, you know, felt more adventurous, and so they would add a line against the cantus firmus, and that was called the tenor, right? And so then they got a little more adventurous years and years later, and they would add a third line, and that line was written against the tenor line, so it was referred to as counter tenor.
I see.
It's that simple.
Yes, thank you. Ian Howell is a counter tenor. He's singing with the American Bach soloists tonight in Davis at the Community Church at 8. Ian Howell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Jeffrey. Have a great day.
Thank you. That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more information about the guests and topics you hear on Insight, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Coming up on KXJZ, a new French film tells of the joys of the ordinary life, and it's become a big hit. But France's president, Nicolas Sarkozy, isn't taking kindly to the movie. He'd like to see a little more ambition in his people. That's coming up in Marketplace. Today's associate producer was Andrew Frischman. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Our interim producer, Robin Souza. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. Children with special medical needs often wait months for life-saving care. On the next Insight, pediatric specialists tell you why they fight for California's sickest children. Plus, members of the Saturday Club reminisce about Sacramento's oldest musical organization, founded in 1893 to enhance the city's cultural life. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow at 2 on KXJZ.